Good evening to you. Daniel chapter 5. In each of the first six chapters of the book of Daniel, God lays out an important lesson for God's people living for God, but living for God very far from home. And in chapter 1, we saw the lesson that God laid out was that it's possible to live for Him even in the face of the greatest pressure that this world can put to us to compromise against Him. In chapter 2, we learned that this man's government and his ways and his rebellious government against God is not going to last forever. It's going to be brought to an end. It's going to be swept away till there's no trace of it left. And God is going to establish His everlasting kingdom here in this world. In chapter 3, we learned, as the three Hebrew children placed within the fire, that God will not allow any of the fires of this world, fires that we're put into, trials that we're put into, because we're unwilling to compromise, to ever work against us. And then we saw in chapter 4 how it is that God is able to take even the people that you think would never get saved and save them, the most powerful, the most wicked, the most whatever in the world. We can't put anyone in that they'll never get saved category because we never know who in the world God is going to save. And sometimes we think that some people are greater miracles than us getting saved. Believe me, I know some of you personally, and if I knew all of you personally, you're a miracle big enough. And so God can save anyone and may save anyone. And that gives us great hope. We need to have that hope within us as we're living here waiting to go home to heaven. And then in chapter 5, he lays down another lesson that's very important. At least it is for me. Now, before chapter 4 and chapter 5, we need to know that there's a period of about 23 years that goes by. And we're introduced to a man by the name of Belshazzar in verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. And Belshazzar is now the king of Babylon. He is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar has died and gone the way of all flesh. And there was a whole series of assassinations and all following Nebuchadnezzar's death as there were struggles for the throne and power for the throne. Ultimately, there was a man by the name of Nabonidus. He took over the reign. He was married to one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters. He was an interesting man. Here he is, the possibility of being the king, and he was technically the king over this Babylonian empire. But he wasn't too hip to the Babylonian premier god, Marduk. And so he didn't like that. He liked the god of the sun, which was the god or the moon god. And that god's name was, interestingly enough, Sin. And so he wanted to give himself to that. Always be careful about gods that are called Sin. But anyway, he was a historian. He was an archaeologist. And he just didn't have it in him to make a bunch of decisions. He wasn't an administrator. He didn't want to rule over an empire and be in on a bunch of board meetings the rest of his life. He liked history. He liked archaeology. And so he gave himself to those things and he made his son kind of a co-regent and let him crunch the numbers and all that kind of stuff while he went and did what essentially amused him most. And so Belshazzar is the grandson by one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters of Nebuchadnezzar. And all of this is interesting in light of what Jeremiah cried out, the accuracy of Jeremiah's words. In Jeremiah 27, verse 6, he said, God prophesying, "And now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve, and all nations shall serve him and his son and his son's son until the very time of his land came. And then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. In other words, Jeremiah was prophesying that Nebuchadnezzar is going to take the southern kingdom of Judah, going to conquer it. He's going to rule over the world. His son is going to rule over the world all the way to his grandson. But there's no mention of the Babylonian Empire continuing beyond the grandson. And of course, it all collapses tonight in chapter 5. So beautiful, the prophecies here of the Old Testament, you know, concerning the future and their fulfillment. Now, one of the interesting things, for many years, you know, you have these liberal scholars, and a liberal scholar is just someone that can't believe that God is bigger than them, which is a pathetic condition. But anyway, we don't want to get off on that. But there are people that believe, they won't believe anything bigger than what they can understand, and so essentially they're engaged in the worship of themselves and the worship of the limitations of their own mind, which is a severe limitation. And so they looked at this, and they, all through the historical records, there was no account concerning a Belshazzar. There's no Belshazzar. So what they did is they spiritualized the entire chapter. Daniel's just making up these names, and he's putting them in the record in order that we can get some kind of a spiritual lesson out of it. Well, comparatively recently, in excavations that they were making, they discovered an entire find in which Belshazzar's name is continually repeated as it relates to that era and related to that kingdom. So aren't you so glad you didn't throw the Bible away? Just let those archaeologists keep digging and everything's going to be fine. God's very much at peace as it relates to his word. And so Belshazzar now is the king, and he has this big drunken feast for 1,000 of his lords, and they drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. Now, what's going on as it relates to Belshazzar? I don't know. We may get out of verse 1 tonight. You just relax related to these things. I'm a speed reader. We'll get there. Don't you worry at all. I have all night. Anyway, you see my new watch right here? It's got a jack-in-the-box on it. I just look hungry. Just get hungry looking at it. A friend of mine, very close personal friend on staff, got this and he gave it to me. Anyway, where in the world are we here in verse 1? Oh, what's going on here is he calls this feast. Now, one of the things that's going on as it relates to all this, he calls this big drunken feast that's in the capital city of the Empire of Babylon, the city of Babylon. And outside of the city, the Medes and the Persians have their armies. They've laid siege to the city. But Belshazzar isn't concerned about it at all. They've got in his mind that city's never going to fall. They've got a wall built all the way around the city. It's a double wall, 300 feet high. It is almost 100 feet thick. You could go chariot races, 4 chariots wide on this wall. There was a water supply that ran from the Euphrates River right through the city. You couldn't cut off their food supplies. They had enough food in the city to last 20 years. In storage. And they had a water supply that ran right through the city. They had 100 guard, towers all the way around the city. The city was 15 miles wide on each of the sides. It was a square. And they figured there's no way that we're going to be taken tonight. I mean, it isn't going to happen. So he calls this drunken party. And essentially, he's saying to the Medes and the Persians, you're never going to take us. There is no way you're going to take that city. But and to the natural eye, there was no way they were going to take that city that night. But God's going to take that city. And what he did was, the leader of the Medo-Persian army there had set up kind of a system for diverting the flow of water from the water supply that was going through the city of Babylon. And what Babylon had done is they had built their gates down right to the level of the water. He deflected the water for a short period of time. It began to go off into fields. It lowered the water level at the gates just long enough for the army to go into the city, and they conquered the entire city without any damage at all. In fact, they went in and killed Belshazzar before even anyone knew that the enemy was inside of the city. So there's a lot of arrogance, there's a lot of pride going on here. There's no belief that this image of the head of gold to be replaced by the shoulders and the chest and the arms of silver, that that's ever going to happen, and yet it's going to happen on that night. And so here they are, this pride, and Belshazzar's essentially communicating to everyone. He's just defying him and saying, we're not as scared of you. And so he's got this testimony to his pride. He's brought in all of his lords, 1,000, you know, sets of adoring eyes just to, you know, to be with him and to speak of how great he is. Now, interesting, related to archaeologists in the excavations of the ancient city of Babylon, they discovered several banquet halls in the ruins of Babylon, all of them of tremendous size. And one banquet hall itself was able to seat over 10,000 people. So they knew how to build a banquet hall. You know, that might be nicer than what some of us are living in. But anyway, that's what they're doing. So they're in this big fancy place that they're in, and they're drinking. He's drinking wine with all of his lords, and they're drinking themselves drunk, essentially. And while he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, God's temple, the God of the Bible, Jehovah Yahweh, to take these silver and gold vessels, which his father, and the word father in the Hebrew, in the Aramaic here, it carries with it the idea of an ancestor, so it can mean grandfather also, which his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. And so he's drinking all of this wine, and as they're all getting drunk on this wine, one of the things that drunkenness does is that it removes something from our lives that's very, very necessary in our lives, and that is this thing called restraint. And he's a proud man, he's an arrogant man, he is a blasphemous man, and he needs all the restraint he can have. And yet now in his drunkenness, he begins to do things that Nebuchadnezzar never even dreamed of doing. In his worst condition, he never dreamed of ever touching those holy vessels that had been brought from Jerusalem into Babylon. And yet now, because of his drunkenness, his resistance gets lowered down, and he knew exactly what those vessels were about. He understood what he was doing here. It wasn't a sin of ignorance that was happening. And so he says, he's drunken, he says, let's bring out those golden and silver vessels now that we might drink from those. And, you know, drunks often say things that, while they're drunk, that they would never say if they weren't drunk. It gives them a kind of a foolish bravery, and that's what he's getting here. So here he begins his whole wild party, and he's communicating a message to the armies outside, we're not afraid of you. And now, as he gets more and more drunk, now he's going to take on God. That's a bad idea, but he decides he's going to do it. And he's essentially saying to God, we're not afraid of you either. We'll bring in his vessels, we'll bring in these vessels of gold and silver, and we'll drink of them here in this, you know, drunken and probably an orgy kind of a thing going on, and everything that was happening here. And so he wants to take the Lord on. Now, those of us who've, you know, been in the study of the Word either here, beginning in the law, and as was laid down the dimensions of the tabernacle, the instruments that God wanted in the tabernacle, that tabernacle and all of these vessels that were used, they were pictures of heaven. The temple that Solomon built was built under God's direction. It was given to David, and it's a picture of heaven. And now they're taking this picture of heaven where God rules and where God reigns, and now they're going to take the instruments from it, and they're going to bring it into their little party. And the interesting thing is, God's watching all of it. He watches everything that goes on in this world. He watches every single thing that goes on in the world. And so he's watching this whole trip that's happening here. And as we've gone through the scriptures, I mean, they were supposed to, you know, offer a sacrifice this way, and then this furnishing was only to be used one time a week associated with this offering. All of it holy, set aside to God for His purposes, speaking of His Son who was to come. You don't get any holier than that. And now they bring all of these things so precious to God and the worship of God, and now they bring it into this party. And it is, for the most part, we're Gentiles, we're non-Jews in here. not exclusively, but for the most part. And so, but for the Jewish mind, reading this, those holy implements being brought into that scene, you couldn't do anything more blasphemous. Unless you were receiving funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. And, you know, when they took that crucifix and put it in a canister of urine and then used my tax dollars to pay for it, that really bugs me. That really bugs me. And so God is more patient than me. And so I look at that, and that's the kind of stuff that really makes my blood boil. People can do what they want, but don't use my money and don't make my money be used for that kind of stuff. And so it's that kind of scene where the stuff would just make a righteous person's blood boil, and I don't know what it does to God, but we're going to see a little bit about that in a minute. It is a scene of extreme blasphemy against God, and it gets worse. You notice that they brought them out then in verse 3. They brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords and his wives, his concubines, drank from them. And they drank wine. And then while they were drinking out of these vessels that were the Lord's vessels, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. And essentially, they're taking God on. They're taking the Lord on, the God of the Bible. And they're saying, listen, he's nobody, he's nothing compared to our gods. We'll drink from his chalices, we'll use his these cups and these vessels, and let's see if he can do anything against our gods as we worship our gods through the use of these vessels. So they're making light of holy things here. And they're just trying to prove the superiority of the Babylonian gods to the God of the Jews. And so they're insulting the Lord, and they're challenging the Lord. And one of the beautiful things is that God is always up to this kind of a challenge. And you notice in verse 5, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. So that's pretty neat. You know, there they are, all drunk and all doing their different thing. All of a sudden, there's a hand that appears, kind of nice. God is very, details are very important to him, and he causes the writing to be on the wall opposite the lampstand so that everyone can see it real good. You ought to have light for that. And so here comes this hand, and it begins to write on the wall. And, the atmosphere changes pretty quickly here as it relates to that. The king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and then the king's countenance, first his face was affected, it changed, that big smirk got off his face real fast. And then his thoughts troubled him. Now his heart and his mind are churning, and his thoughts are troubling him so much that the joints of his hips are loosed. He's lost control of his hips here, and then his knees started to knock against each other. Now, I've been in situations where I've been petrified. I mean petrified, but I've never lost it like that. This guy's more petrified than where I've ever been. Maybe you've been there, and you understand what it is that he's in the middle of, but he has lost his physical ability to control himself in light of what has happened. Now, the interesting thing is, why did he automatically know it was bad news? Guilty conscience. He knew he was doing wrong. And within mankind, there is a conscience. We know by that conscience, whether a person is saved or not, there's a sense of right and a sense of wrong and the knowledge that I always ought to do what is right and I ought never to do what is wrong. Why didn't he see the writing on the wall and say, oh, good, a message that the Medes and the Persians are going to be defeated? Because he knew better than that. He knew that he was doing wrong, and in that doing wrong condition, it could only be bad news for him. And so he knew that there was news here. He didn't know exactly what the news was, but he knew it couldn't be any good, and the news is essentially the party is over. And so, and then in verse 7, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, bring in the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. And so these guys, they had tenure or something. And so here they are, been around, you know, this whole lineage of them from Nebuchadnezzar's time. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, which was a sign of favor. Not everyone had purple. That was a very valuable cloth in those days. They'll have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall become the third ruler in the kingdom. And so Belshazzar is saying, I'm going to offer you the highest position I can. Number one's already taken, number two's already taken, but I'm going to offer you the third place in the kingdom, plus a nice purple robe and a gold chain for a kingdom that ends tonight. But anyway, he didn't know that at that point. Now, here, just when you think that these wise men have a chance to break out of what is a fairly deep rut they've been in terms of not being able to answer anything, they strike out a third time. Now, all of the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. And then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. And so they know that there's some real trouble going on. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about their inability to give the interpretation of what was written on the wall gives us some interesting insight into a passage in the New Testament, and that is that the carnal mind cannot understand the things of the Spirit. And it was the Spirit that put those things on the wall. They could not understand it. It would take a child of God to understand what it was that was happening. So they're drawing a complete blank here as it relates to what is going on. So they're still in the astonished condition. Probably word begins to spread through the palace pretty quickly that this party has gone bad and that there's big trouble in there, starts to filter out, fan out through the palace, and word comes to the queen mother there in verse 10. The queen hears about it, and the queen is probably a reference to one of Nebuchadnezzar's wives who was still living at the time. So she comes into the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his lords. She came into the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in the kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. Now, listen in the next couple of verses to her description of Daniel. What a great reputation to have. And God help us all. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father or grandfather, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding, interpreting of dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. And so here is Daniel now, apparently for a period of at least 23 years, he's been pretty much forgotten, pretty much forgotten. He's doing his job. He's doing his job as unto the Lord, but nobody prizes what he's about anymore. Nebuchadnezzar has died, has gone into anarchy in terms of the fight for the crown and all of that. Nobody cares about him. Nobody considers what he has to say valuable until today. Until today. It's so important as God's people to be ready. You never know. Things come and happen in people's lives that where they're not interested in hearing what you and I have to say for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and one day something happens and all of a sudden you're called for. All of a sudden there's a desire to hear what you have to say by your God. And the important thing is to stay in that place of being used by the Lord while we wait for that time. So often it's just a matter of waiting. It was interesting when I used to work for the phone company and I got saved and I witnessed to everyone at the phone company. It was great. And here I am, this lineman, and lineman, you have this whole macho thing, you climb poles and you do these things up there and everything, and you just grunt to one another, and two grunts means, get me that, and, you know, and you have this whole deal on the whole thing, you get your muscles and all that kind of stuff. And so all these things, and here I'm coming from being one of them, and a grunter from way back, and now I know the Lord, and I'm inviting him to concerts and telling about the Lord and all this kind of stuff. And I'm pretty alone in the yard, you know, after a while. But a few people started to get saved. But what was interesting to me over the long haul was when I would get paired up with people, not everyone, for sure not everyone, but I would get paired up to work with different people, or people would seek me out later when something began to happen with one of their kids or in their marriage or something like that. And they'd never seek me out in the yard. Hey, I want to talk to you about Christ, Damien. You know, I mean, it's never anything like that. It'd be some quiet little thing where they'd get you away. And the importance of just being ready. God brings people to that place. And the key, as it relates to what God is trying to do, is not only to bring them to that place, but then to have us, by His grace, to be ready when He does. And not just off doing our own thing because we think they're never going to listen to us. Our responsibility is to be ready. And Daniel was ready. And Daniel then, verse 13, was brought in before the king. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that, just the last minute, but I've heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. And now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple." This is, sounds like Monty Hall, doesn't he? "And you'll have a chain of gold around your neck, and you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom." And so Belshazzar offers Daniel the same reward. And then Daniel answered and said to the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another." In other words, keep it. Keep it. I don't want to be third in a kingdom that's going to collapse in about 5 hours. Thank you. And so, and it's a good attitude to have in the world too, because we're in a world that's getting ready to collapse. And so that wasn't, he wanted to represent the Lord. He wanted to be true to the Lord. Now, remember with Nebuchadnezzar, when he got that interpretation concerning the madness that was going to come upon Nebuchadnezzar, he said to Nebuchadnezzar, "Oh, let this be to your enemies. Don't let this be to you." You know, he had a friendship, a fondness, saw something in Nebuchadnezzar, but here there is nothing like that. He just says, "Listen, you can keep your stuff. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." And I think one of the reasons that Daniel declines the offer of the wealth and the position is not only because he didn't need it. And one of the things it's important to understand about Daniel is that Daniel is in his late 70s and he's, or his 80s now at this time in his life. He was a kid dealing with Nebuchadnezzar. Now he's, you know, he's a salty guy. He's been around and served the Lord for a long time, not impressed by anything about the world. Is salty a bad thing anyway? If it is, scratch that. Have to be careful of slang, you know, you get that kind of stuff. But anyway, he's been around and not impressed by any of it. And he wants to communicate to him that you're going to get your interpretation, but you're not going to get it because you bought it from me. And because you cannot make the servant of God, you cannot make the prophet of God do any better of a job for you by paying them these sums. We do what we do faithfully between us and God. And so he's saying, "I'm going to do what I'm going to do, but it has nothing to do with this offer. So I decline the offer." So you'll know that power and money had nothing to do with it. He said, "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor." The Most High God. You've got these little gods of gold and silver and all these little things. Let me tell you about the Most High God. And he begins to give him now a history lesson that he was familiar with, but he chose to ignore. "And because of the majesty that the Most High God gave to your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, All peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. He was the grand poobah. I mean, he was the big guy. He thought he was the biggest guy till he met God. But when his heart was lifted up in pride and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took, that is the watchers, his glory from him. And then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling place was like the wild donkeys. And they fed him with the grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints it over whomever he chooses. Belshazzar, your grandfather learned a lesson, and he learned it the hard way so that you wouldn't need to learn it the hard way. And that is that no matter how big of a big shot anyone is in this world, they're always infinitely smaller than the Most High God. And so this was what was learned. But you, verse 22, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this. And that's one of the worst characteristics in a leader, is a failure to be a learner, or to learn from history, or to learn from other people's mistakes. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords. And it's interesting how often you and you and you and your is repeated in here. And your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the Lord, who holds your breath in his hand and owns all of your ways, you have not glorified. And then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written. And so, Belshazzar, you think you're in control of everything. You're not in control of even your next breath. That's a gift from God. And so he said, here's what was written on the wall. Verse 25, this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And then he gives him the interpretation of it. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. And so Mene means numbered. And so there was the numbered that was written there. And then Daniel gives it the further interpretation. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, which means weighed. He said, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And then Perez, which is a singular form of Upharsin. You, in the Aramaic here, means and. And so it means and Pharsin or and Perez. And Perez means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. And that was the message that was given to him. And then Belshazzar gave the command. They clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck, made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And so Belshazzar rewards David. I mean, Daniel, and what a picture that must have been. Well, okay. Anyway, verse 30. And that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And so Darius the king came in. Darius became the king over that empire. Ultimately, he would work things in such a way, God would, that Cyrus would come in over that kingdom. But here it is, the fulfillment, the beginning of the fulfillment of that dream that God had given to Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold giving way now to the Medo-Persian Empire, the arms, the chest of silver, just as God has said. I'd never bet against God's word. It doesn't make any sense to do it, because every single bit of it is going to come to pass. Heaven and earth is going to pass away, Jesus said. His word is never going to pass away. And so on that night, we're told by the historians that they made their way in the way that they did by lowering the canal that went through the city, and they took the city. And the interesting thing is that because Belshazzar and his father, who was off doing different things, were worshiping other gods than were predominantly worshipped in the city of Babylon, and because of their debauchery and because of a lot of other things, the people actually cheered when they were taken by the Medes and the Persians. And so I don't know how well that goes in the polls, but that was what happened there. They were happy to be rid of those guys. And so what do we learn here in chapter 5? I think the supreme lesson that we learn in chapter 5 is that God is able to defend himself. I don't know about anybody else, but I need to remember that. That God is able to defend himself. Remember Peter, on the morning that Jesus was crucified there in the Garden of Gethsemane, they come to arrest Jesus. What does he do? He pulls a sword out and he begins to flail that sword, and he's going to defend Jesus. He's going to defend God. And the most that he was able to do was he took off the one ear of the servant of the high priest. And so here he is. He's not very good at this. Remember, he's a fisherman. And so he's flailing this thing around. He's going to defend God, you know. And all of a sudden, he goes out there and he says, "So there's an ear." And he just goes in. And so this ear goes to the ground. And I mean, I don't know if the whole place kind of just froze there with that ear on the ground. But I do know that Jesus noticed what was going on here. And Jesus looks over at Peter and in essence says, "What are you doing? You know, you're creating work for me here." And he takes the ear, and he heals the Malchus, the servant of the high priest, heals him related to the ear. And prior to doing that, Jesus said to Peter, "Don't you understand that at my word, 12 legions of angels could be here? A legion is 6,000. He said, "Don't you understand? At my word, 72,000 angels could be on this scene." It's not out of control, Peter. You think it's out of control, but it's not out of control. And Peter, "What could I do more?" And it's interesting, you take those 72,000 angels, and then on one night, one angel killed 180,000 Assyrians in the Old Testament. You multiply those two numbers, and you get an idea. I mean, Jesus was not in trouble. He wasn't in trouble. You add to that the fact that Jesus had told Peter and the disciples everything that was going to happen. He was going to Jerusalem. He was going to be arrested. He was going to be taken before the religious leaders and tried. He was going to be crucified. They knew everything that was going to happen, and that it was the will of God that it should happen. And when it began to happen, Peter freaked. And I am the same way. God has told me what the end times are going to look like. And even though he has told me what the end times look like, when I see them, I still want to pull my sword out and start taking ears off. And he rebuked James and John earlier in his public ministry. Jesus did. They were the sons of thunder. And I am a son of thunder. I'm a zealot. I'm a zealot. I work hard to kind of keep that back a little bit. Sometimes I'm more successful, sometimes less successful. But I'm a zealot. And a zealot, that's not a virtue. That's something that has some good aspects to it, but there's some bad ones too. So Jesus, they wanted to go up through the area of Samaria there, and one of the cities there wouldn't allow Jesus to stay in there and all. And James and John come back to Jesus, and they said, "Listen, they're not even going to let us go through there. They're not going to let us stay there. Shall we call fire down from heaven and consume them?" And you read that, and it sounds like a great idea to me in my flesh, you know. "Don't let them do that to you, God. I mean, come on, we got to set a precedence around here. You just got to fry a few people, and we'll get things taken care of in the United States of America, you tell me. I know a few buildings, you just fry them all right in there, you know. We just fry them, you know, everything. I've got the addresses and their phone numbers. I call them regularly about legislation, you know." So anyway, you see, this comes out sometimes in me. So I can know what it's all going to look like on the religious realm, the spiritual realm, geographically, politically, the whole thing, and I can still get so anxious about it, and I'm going to defend God in a situation that he has told me would be in existence when it happened, so I would not respond that way. And so he said to James and John, you don't know what spirits you are. I didn't come to kill people, I came to save people. And so they were to give themselves to a message of grace, that the kingdom of God was there. Get out, like Peter said, from this perverse generation and get into the kingdom of God. But they were to leave the judgment to God. And God can take care of the judgment, and he will take care of the judgment. Now, the Bible teaches that we are to be salt and light in this world. We are to use every opportunity. Salt is an influence. Light was an influence for good. We're to use every opportunity that we have to be an influence for the kingdom of God in this world. That's what we're to do. But in this world that we're living in, especially in what God has described will be the case in the last days, there are certain things only he can do. And I can't do it for him. He doesn't want me doing it for him. So we're to live hot for him. We're to live a salty life. We're to live a lit life in these last days, where he's called me to be that and to do that. But then beyond that, I have to trust him to do what he alone can do. And for me as a zealot, that is a peaceful thing for me, because I can do that. I can do what he's called me to do in the little place that he's called me to do it in. That I can do. I can't do the big picture. I can't do his job for him. He doesn't want me to do his job for him. And so I take that deep Jack LaLanne breath, the mighty Wurlitzer goes, and I relax and I say, that's right, I'm not God. God has to do what he alone can do, but I'm going to give myself fully to what he's called me to do. And so the chapter teaches us that God is able to defend himself and take care of his reputation, and he will do it. And one of the things that I love in this chapter is that when Daniel comes on the scene, he's nothing like me. Of course, he's quite a bit older. I hope to be a little mellower at that point in my life, in my 80s. Otherwise, I won't see my 80s. Lord tarries. But anyway, he comes into this whole ungodly scene. He's off in another part of the palace. He knows this big thing is going on. And you notice he wasn't in the palace trying to, you know, get a feel for where the sinners are today so he could relate to them in his preaching. He was off doing what God had called him to do. And then when he gets called on into that scene, completely peaceful. Completely peaceful. He did what God had called him to do in that situation. He spoke for God, but it was up to God to fulfill his word and up to God to take care of this broad, extreme wickedness of Babylon. And so that beautiful peace, there's that balance, isn't there? There's that place where we look and we say, yes, I'm going to be salt and light. But then there's that realization, I need to do that where God has put me, and do that to the fullest. And some of you are involved in some very interesting realms. You're involved in political things for the glory of God and social things for the glory of God. All of us in a spiritual sense for the glory of God. These different things that God has you. But we do those things. But there's the recognition, God, I'm doing this out of obedience to you. But the big picture is yours. You have to take care of your name in these last days. And he is able to do that. And it gives me hope, because I can do that. I can't do the other thing. So a beautiful, beautiful lesson here of Daniel chapter 5.